This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Leon Botstein knows a lot about a lot of things, and as your fellow American, he thinks you should too. During his tenure as president of Bard College, Botstein has taken on the challenge of creating the ideal citizen. This year, Bard introduced a mandatory science education seminar for all the school's freshmen. Botstein has advocated for the reform of the country's secondary education system, arguing that students should graduate high school after the 10th grade, not the 12th. And in his free time, Botstein conducts the American Symphony Orchestra, performing rare works in venues like Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center, and is the music director of the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra as well. Leon Botstein is in town to talk with Duke students and to participate in a colloquium on the Duke campus tonight. And he is with us here on the program today. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk with you about Bard because you write on the college's website that the school tries to urge students to think about their place in the world. Is that different than other colleges and how so?
Well, it's primarily different because of what the institution does. We have the largest prison education program in the country. We have 300 prisoners getting BA degrees and AA degrees. We run two public high schools in the city of New York in which people from all over the city go. They enter the ninth grade. By the end of the 12th grade, they finish 2 years of college. They essentially cut high school short. We have programs abroad in Palestine, in Kyrgyzstan, in Russia, in South Africa. We do a lot of things in the arts. So we are actually a publicly spirited place. So a student comes to be an undergraduate there, has an environment of service and civic engagement, which goes along with becoming a chemist, a biologist, a mathematician, or going to medical school or law school.
Why is that the academy's role?
Why is the
this idea of civic engagement, of involving students in the community, of making sure the academy has a place, a presence in prisons and Kyrgyzstan and places where there might be conflict, why?
Well, the significant point is that in our time, education is power. And in order to really influence and make democracy work, knowledge is essential. You simply can't make decisions about the environment without knowing something about what the issues are. How do we evaluate the nuclear disaster in Japan? What are the statistics? What does nuclear radiation do? Why is it bad? At what level is it bad? I mean, if we operate with such ignorance and fear, the decisions we'll make will be bad. So understanding the world is crucial to doing the right thing, or protecting the values that we cherish, freedom, civility, a respect for our fellow human beings. So in a democracy, education is far more important than it ever has been. So the civic engagement is a way of linking learning to life. And people go to school and they say, well, I need grades. I need to get ahead. I need to earn money. That's terrific. But what's the context in which you're going to get grades, earn money, and work? So in a way, what you want to begin to do in an undergraduate life is to connect the interests you have, the need to know. You know, people get ambitions. They want to help cure cancer. There are a lot of things they want to do which are terrific. They want to help their fellow human being. Well, they have to understand how that works in a much larger complex system of which they're going to take a place themselves as adults.
So how does the academy, how do colleges and universities do that? And maybe I should ask the question another way. Are they doing that, or is there something going on in universities that are an obstacle to that broader understanding of context and where you're education belongs?
I don't think university is an obstacle. I think actually that too much of the academic experience in undergraduates is sort of segregated into very narrow specialties and departments, which is understandable. But the students don't really quite understand why they're learning something, or there's a real Jekyll and Hyde. They're very good students, but the moment the classroom stops, there's no connection between the way they conduct their lives and what they're learning. So they're very good students on the one hand, but their social life and their public life is really not connected to what they're doing in the classroom.
Let me make an argument that the market has had something to do with that. In other words, something outside the academy has had something to do with that. A student who knows they're going to come out of college or university in debt knows that they better get a good job and get on that train very, very fast. Fast track to that is to specialize, is to segregate, is to get yourself in a cell and make sure you are the top student in one area and go get that money.
perfectly good thing to do. There's one thing. Everything you said is great. I'm in favor of it. Except there's one thing wrong. We haven't told the person to really compete. You can't live in that cell alone. That the real cutting edge of all subject matter is not discreetly cut the way a butcher would a specific cut. It's connected to the whole body of the animal which you're looking for one cut, to use that metaphor. So the fact remains that at the top edge of any field is a connection to some other. So that very narrow, if you want to be a really competitive engineer, you got to know something about the world you're engineering for. If you want to be a really competitive physician, you have to know not only about the disease, but the patients and who they are and how treatments affect lives. In other words, if you want to compete for the security of income, status in society, you have to do more than imitate a definition of professionalism that was inherited from the previous generation.
How would universities change to make more of that possible?
I think in the undergraduate sphere, and the graduate sphere, they'd rethink the way they're training professionals. So I think we are at a moment where we need to rethink legal education, medical education, business education. We also need to rethink the way we teach science and the humanities. One of the worst things about teaching of literature, it seems totally irrelevant. Why should somebody study literature? A kid goes to college and the parents have taken debt out, can hardly afford it, the kid can't afford it, and they say, what do you mean, you're studying poetry? Who needs that? Well, we don't have a good answer. There is a good answer, but we don't actually, the academic world doesn't actually provide that answer so simply and well.
What is the answer?
The answer is that poetry leads you to understand something about life and human nature that can't be said simply in a easily standardized test exam. It is about the gray and unambiguous, unpredictable area of human experience and imagination. It's the same thing that theology teaches you, that thinking about faith, thinking about poetry, thinking about music and art, this leads you to an understanding of the human character and the human community that actually is useful. That there's no such thing as knowledge that is unuseful. Inspiration comes in unbelievably unpredictable ways. You know, Einstein, Newton, those are people who weren't actually just following a goal. And they are the real innovators.
No, and when you look at the Romantic period, certainly the scientists were also poets and writers, and they had a poetic vision of the future that drove them to their science, right?
Absolutely. The thing that inspired Einstein was the fact that the aesthetic solutions, the aesthetic character of the solutions for the problem of space and time didn't seem right to him. There was an aesthetic instinct built on his love of Mozart.
But in the meantime, we have learned to specialize, and some of our best university professors are specialists themselves. Have we gone too far down the wrong track to build ourselves an academy with the specialists who understand the poetic imagination and scientific imagination need to be taught in the same classroom?
Well, a specialist is a good thing. My argument is not – it's the way the specialists are organized. It's the bureaucratic structure, how disciplines are structured that the problem is, not specialization. Real knowledge has to be in some way specialized. You can't be a generalist. It's hard to be a generalist. Impossible, really. But it is the way the specialties are defined and where the linkages are. And we're still working with a somewhat 19th century definition of the university, the way we define departments. So in one university, let's say political theory, the nature of law. There are people worrying about it in political science departments, in philosophy departments, in law schools, in business schools. Are they really talking to each other? And are they talking to people who are writing about literature or history that intersect with the same problems? Do we really have a community of scholars that develops a curriculum that inspires young people to think that learning is not only important for their earning life, but for their civic life?
And you left out laboratories that are important in the study of the law when it comes to defining human life and DNA research.
Absolutely.
And that, genetic research. So putting them together, finding ways to imagine those specialists working together and collaborating and making sure that students somehow have had access to all of that. And you've done something like that at Bard, the idea of the citizen scientist. Tell us about what it means for freshmen now to study science.
The first year student comes and in 3 weeks, ungraded but required, they do a three-week intensive laboratory-based study of the nature of infectious disease. A common question, what is an infectious disease? Let's say, let's take the question of a virus that we're worried about, or a flu. swine flu. So what makes something infectious? Then they study the question of what are the modes of intervention, what are the modes of prevention, and what are the social consequences? To be able for them to think, well, how do I measure the risks of taking a vaccine, not taking a vaccine? What's the societal implications of it? What is a vaccine? What does a vaccine do? What does it not do? Is it sensible to put a mask over you when you go into the subway? Do you stay home when you sniffle? I mean, people in public life who have degrees or in private life know so little about their bodies, about medicine, and they don't even know how to read what's on the internet and sort of figure out what's nonsense and what is nonsense. So the mathematics, the biology, an orientation of how to read science and understand what scientists do is something we don't really do very well for non-scientists in American universities.
One of the collateral benefits, it seems to me, is that then you'd understand how to read newspapers and listen to radio programs and evaluate the information and read polls, for that matter, and evaluate information.
Take, for example, this terrible fraud that was perpetrated about the relation of autism to a vaccine. It was a fraud. Now, the fact is, to understanding why someone thought it was plausible, what would be the evidentiary basis, how someone falsified it, and why it's not true. And people still believe the Earth is flat. Well, you have to be able to have a conversation with people to show that their belief the Earth is flat is, if we don't walk around worrying about the curvature because the roundness of the Earth doesn't influence our daily life. On the other hand, we have to be able to use evidence to persuade people that they're right or they're wrong about matters that we can actually agree upon before we make public policy.
Leon Botstein is my guest today. He's in the area to talk to Duke students about education and about music. We'll talk with the Bard College president in a moment and continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Leon Botstein, president of Bard College in upstate New York, conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra, music director of the Jerusalem Symphony, in town to discuss the state of higher education with Duke students with us right now. You have a proposal that a suggestion that high schools go on too long. 2 years is plenty. Tell us more about that.
Well, my view is that, especially with the financial crisis, we should reduce the American system to a two-tier system, elementary and secondary. The middle school and junior high school, I think, has proven to be a disaster. So, in addition, we have evidence that people mature earlier. Menstruation, the onset of puberty is earlier than it used to be. We need also to recognize that society treats young people as consumers, as adults. But in school, we treat them like large children. So my view is end high school at 16. We waste the kids in their adolescent years. We don't have the teachers who know the subjects well enough. We don't have people teaching physics, mathematics, biology, who really know what they're talking about. We catch the kids' interest in science in particular, which is important for the economy, too late when they enter college at 18. So let's end high school early and let people choose what they want to study and go to the collegiate system. That would work, I think, for about 40%, maybe 50% of the high school population. It would reduce the cost by 2 years and eliminate the infrastructure of a lot of overcrowding in community colleges. And people would commute to college from home, or they would go to college at 16, which is really, in maturation terms, what 18 was 75 years ago. So it is a way of getting young people at an earlier age to really become interested in subjects with a need to know and being taught by real professionals, PhDs in physics and mathematics and biology. And so they actually become excited about a subject area, the way apprentices would have been in the 18th century who decided to become cabinet makers.
So the first thing, though, that does occur to me is that saving that you talked about, on the one hand, saves the state. There are a lot of parents who this becomes an enormous cost for. On the other side, some parents who wouldn't be able to. So that's 2 years of education for poorer families that are simply lost because they can't afford college?
No, because they would go to community college. In other words, it seems to me that the way we do it in New York, we have two public high schools like this in New York. We're about to open one in Newark, New Jersey. So we actually bring the college into the high school. So what happens is that 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So they, at the end of the 12th grade, these young people get a high school diploma and a 2-year college AA degree.
So you're really talking about restructuring the whole system,
absolutely,
top to bottom, and making sure that if we're going to talk about biology and these other courses, we got people to know how to teach them.
And the most important thing is to bypass the education schools. The real terrible thing about American schools is we don't have good enough teachers who are well enough trained. And that's the irony of all the teacher bashing that's going on now, The fact is we're not recruiting the best of American undergraduates into the teaching profession, and we're not training them well. So the university system still, to some extent, knows how to do this. So this is a way of connecting the Faculty of Arts and Sciences to the high school education.
What about – you've also talked about the graduate program, just the way undergraduate and graduate programs are structured are wasteful and in many cases misplaced, that students get the wrong idea about what their education is about.
Yes. I think that too many graduate programs, some of them take too long, and too much of their education is simply an extension of a highly professionalized undergraduate education. So I think we have to rethink what we train people to do when they get a PhD and when they get really involved in a particular subject. In addition, I think that the base of undergraduate education needs to be wider so that the person going into biology or into physics or into English hasn't had essentially 7 years of a graduate education but a broader education before they got to graduate school and a more intense and a more effective graduate education at the PhD level.
So it sounds like you're talking about, again, a restructuring. And I wonder what the relationship between then the academy and the big wide world or the market is in terms of getting its signals. How do we know what to teach? How do we know where to put our resources? I know Holden Thorpe, the chancellor of UNC, has co-written a book with Buck Goldstein. And in this book, looks at entrepreneurship and says entrepreneurship is something we need to be teaching. Not that all students need to be entrepreneurs, but that it has to be a component of a university education. What do you think?
But entrepreneurship has to be inscribed in the very essence of what the American university does. I don't think it's a separate art. It is about encouraging people to think for themselves, to be the driving force of knowledge, to develop the motivation themselves, and to frame the questions. The hardest thing to teach is not entrepreneurship. It's how to ask the right question. And the right question is, you know, sometimes about miniaturization. Can I have a phone that has no wires? You know, how can I communicate without, hard material means? So it is about teaching imagination and thought in every discipline and area of inquiry. If you get people who think for themselves, you'll get entrepreneurs. The reason the American university system has worked so well is because we, from the very early on, that's the one good thing about our school system, is that we still have the idea that the child needs to speak. The child needs to own what it is he or she says. They're not simply a passive vessel. Now, a lot of the high-stakes testings has sort of eroded this tradition, but it's a very good tradition. And the university, what do you think? You know, a graduate student who comes in with a good idea is prized. Isn't said, well, sit down, you're not the boss. So the anti-authoritarian aspect of teaching is very important. That's what builds entrepreneurship. But the fact is that knowledge will drive the economy. And knowledge is not predictable because, you know, it is often unexpected and unpredictable discoveries. For example, the solution to DNA by Watson and Crick, no one thought at that time it would have as much of a practical possibility in the economy it has now. Solving information mathematics, right, in the early generation before the computer, no one had an idea there would be a PC and internet and stuff like that. So it is – the university is messy. It's not efficient. But it is the home increasingly of what will be gainful employment for our citizens. So it has to really in its own business train originality, not imitative thought, not copying, not simply off a cookie cutter of established knowledge. And that's entrepreneurship.
Isn't that a scary prospect, though? And again, it gets back to a question we talked about earlier, but we can look at it in context of what you just said. This subtle distinction between knowing that we need a lot more people in IT, the market is demanding them, so I'm going to study that, or in the professions. What does it mean to be a doctor? Here's what you study. You come out, you get the certificate, I'm a doctor. What you don't do is assume that if I learn to think, I'm going to come up with that idea that the market will embrace. That's too scary with $100,000 debt.
No, it's not scary because the two are not separate. I become a doctor. Let's take your doctor model. Now, I've learned some computer science. I've been taught how to think as a doctor. I'm also be able to look at the patient and understand where he or she comes from, right? Now I'm working as a doctor. Now I get some good idea. What about delivering information by computer to the home of the patient? How can I innovate and make my life as a practicing doctor more interesting? How can I invent a product that, in fact, no one else has thought about, that I know the patient needs? Now I'm an inventor. At the same time, I'm earning money. I'm seeing patients every day. I'm bringing up my family. I got an income. I got a pension fund. But I'm also sitting up at night thinking, there's a different way of doing this, a better way of doing this, which doesn't cut into my income. It's not a choice between practicality and lack of practicality. It's about any business owner. I have a pizza joint. How can I make my pizza better? I was talking to a pizza entrepreneur, Two Boots Pizza. Now he's got some kind of Cajun pizza idea. He's doing really well. Who would ever thought we need another pizza chain? The people have designed jeans. I thought, well, there was only Levi's, right? Now there are 1,000 different jean manufacturers. That's entrepreneurship, but it comes either from marketing or convincing the public they want something they don't need, like another pair of jeans, or it can be actually genuine, how to deliver better medical care to the patient. And so that's the kind of thinking that can be taught in the professional schools and in undergraduate schools as well.
Not to mention, I guess, the value of the humanities. If you were to study the humanities and understood the impact of narrative and how storytelling has an effect on your patient and could inform you about what's really going on, it might even make you a better
Absolutely.
Doctor.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you think about pain and suffering, what is the most important body of human experience expressed in literature? So, and psychological sensibility, if you're trying to help people in a counseling profession, literature, I mean, there's not something that isn't useful. It's up to you, the entrepreneur of knowledge, to make it useful.
Not to mention, we talked about literature, but music as well. You are the conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra. When did you become interested in music?
Well, that's my original career. I mean, in other words, I got caught into administration and education through my primary interest in music. So I would say that, you know, it's true, you know, President Broadhead of Duke is a scholar in English. So each of us who is in this position has come through a field. The President Princeton is a molecular biologist. So I happen to be a musician. That's an anomaly.
And the works that you perform tend to be the works of obscure composers. They tend to be, at least that's what the critics say. Is that a choice of yours, a deliberate choice?
Deliberate choice. They're not obscure. They're simply forgotten. I mean, I would be so happy to be as obscure as the people I perform. In music, unlike in painting, where we have a museum where you can go through the whole museum and it's everything from the Mona Lisa and the Louvre to all kinds of other artists who are in the museum and treasured by the museum and available to the public. In the music business, we've become prisoners of a kind of very narrow masterpiece syndrome. So we play Mahler symphonies all over again, Beethoven symphonies all over again, Brahms, and we assume the public doesn't want to hear anything else. What we are in the business, what I'm in the business of doing with others, is to open up all the closed rooms of the Museum of Music History of the 20th and 19th centuries, particularly, to wonderful works that the public will love. And I don't understand why people don't perform them.
I want to play a little piece from composer William Grant Still. This is a clip from Land of Romance. That is a little piece from The Land of Romance by composer William Grant Still. Tell us about Still and why you chose that.
Well, Still is a good example. Here's an African-American composer from the mid-century. Nobody's ever heard of him except a few group of aficionados. Why is he forgotten? Not because his music isn't beautiful. Just in the politics, he was actually a conservative, anti-communist, anti-liberal. He didn't agree with Paul Robeson. He didn't agree with Langston Hughes, with whom he collaborated. So he was kind of pariah because in the liberal McCarthy period, he was an African-American on the side of the anti-communists, and he was not on the side of the liberals. So he was dismissed two ways, as an African-American and then as a conservative. So he fell through the cracks. Great American composer. Now, there are many like him in history. Beautiful music, fabulous music, very accessible to the public, very deeply expressive, and who had a great success in his lifetime. He was a person of real stature. So why we decided to erase these people's memory? And so our job is to bring back next week, for example, in New York, we're doing a concert of Walter Piston, great American composer of the mid-century. Wonderful music. We're in the business of trying to expand the repertoire, because classical music will die if you simply go to the same film. I mean, people simply don't go in droves to watch Casablanca every year, five times a year. I love the film. You love the film. But you're interested in seeing the new film, or you would love to see a restored copy of a great film you heard about but never saw that might become a classic for you that you didn't know. So we're in the business of trying to recover, like an archaeologist would, the historical memory of the past.
But it seems that music directors disagree with you by their actions. They seem to think the only way they can survive is to play the greatest hits.
They're entirely wrong, and they're too lazy and too ignorant. And the managers drive them by fear. So we have turned music into a showbiz. You know, we think, you know, it's a sort of a visual spectacle of repeat of things you already know, and we try to Hollywoodize it. It's not going to work. Because the fact is, the public is too smart and it's too boring. And finally, you know, the Beethoven symphonies and the Mahler symphonies, they're wonderful things. You know, once a year maybe, once every 2 years, they need to be put on the shelf. New music and other music from the past that the public really loves that gives them something to talk about. I mean, if I go to hear a Beethoven symphony, I can't tell my date, well, I didn't like it. You know, but I go to the movies, it's part of my conversation. She liked it, I didn't like it. But, you know, it's like going to church. You can't say I don't like the Bible. You know, that's why I'm there to begin with. So we need to open it up so it's more free and more exciting and interesting, the way we would in a museum. We need to curate the concerts. You know, we go to a museum, which is American painting, you know, at the turn of the century. Well, we know it's a sort of subject connected to history. Music has to be connected through the concert life to politics, to literature, to art.
Well, and William Grant Still seems to me one of the good examples of that. We can talk about the politics of the era and how he got caught up in
that. That's right. And then you can listen to it. We've done programs about what it's like to write music under a dictator, music under Stalin. Not only Shostakovich, but other composers. Mm-hmm. And people can understand, well, what's this all about? You know, what is it to mean to be an African-American in mid-century in the politics of America? That they can relate to. We're doing a program with the Whitney Museum that is together with an exhibit on an American painter, Lionel Feininger. And so connecting art and music. We've done programs on Byron and on Whitman and American writers and music, on politics. How did the national identity get formed? How did Hungarian national identity get formed? Polish national identity? Through music as a medium.
One of the things you also worry about is that we have somehow sequestered dissent, that we really don't want to, or we don't really have the forum, the proper fora to express our dissent and change over time.
Yeah, look, people don't like to hear something they don't already believe. It would be, you know, people say you should be able to take criticism. Nobody likes criticism. By the same token, people don't like to be contradicted. People go to public speeches and turn on the internet and go to sites and watch TV programs that confirm their prejudices already. You know, but we need to show that it's enjoyable to be wrong. I would vote for a candidate who in a public debate said, you know, I never thought of that. You're right, to his or her opponent. That would give me confidence in someone. But that's not what we define as debate. We define as staking and labeling the position and calling it quits.
Do you think things have changed over time? Things have gotten worse or was it
much worse? Much worse.
Why?
Because I don't know. That's a mystery. More people have gone to school. More people are satisfied with reductive solutions. No child left behind. Tea party. Phrases. Bullets. You know, that describe complex issues. Most of the life is gray. It isn't black or white. You know, it isn't that government is good and no government is bad or no government is, you know, it's not that simple. And the public seems satisfied with a simplistic view of the world. Also, the public doesn't want to hear any bad news because they don't believe they can get out of the bad news. There's not everybody needs government services. It's nonsense. How can we live without government services? And how is it going to be paid? And what about inefficiency? Well, inefficiency is only part of it. Revenue has to be part of it. It's commonsensical. And if only people had the courage to speak the truth to the American people, And sometimes the truth isn't always that easy. But I would trust the doctor who tells me what I really have to struggle against, as opposed to the doctor says, don't worry, just take this pill and you'll be fine.
There was a time, though, don't you think, that people believed somehow, even in the back of their mind, even if nobody wants to be told they're wrong or disagreed with, they believed that there was something about the process of getting together and arguing that would cause a change and make things better even though we don't like this process. Now that's changed.
That's changed. And there are two reasons in my view. One is that too many people have mixed, in my view, absolutist ideas that derive from religion. They're not talking to you. God has talked to them first. Now, once God has talked to them, I'm lost because either it's not my God or how can you argue with the divine? That's number one. The second is that I think there is a loss of optimism that we collectively as a nation, you know, we believe this weird journalistic idea that America's on the decline. Well, you know, America's decline is like worrying that the world is revolving around the sun. You know, maybe yes, maybe no, but in terms of our lifetime, the lifetime of our children, there's no decline. What are we worried about? First, we were about Japan. Now we're about China. Well, that's maybe an inspiration, but we seem to have lost the collective idea that we can actually respond.
Leon Botstein, my guest today, thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Leon Botstein's president of Bard College, conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra, music director of the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra, speaks tonight at a colloquium called Intellectual Curiosity and the Professional Life, Will Your Elite Education Fall Short? Starts at 5:30 at the Rare Book Room at Perkins Library at Duke, free and open to the public. Next up, Jane Borden's experiences as a North Carolina debutante in the Big Apple. Stay tuned.